As I've previously discussed, the law of the few says that one critical factor in epidemics is the nature of the messenger. A pair of shoes or a warning or an infection or a new movie can become highly contagious and tip simply by being associated with a particular kind of person. But in all those examples, I took it as a given that the message itself was something that could be passed on. Paul Revere started a word-of-mouth epidemic with the phrase, "The British are coming." If he had instead gone on that midnight ride to tell people he was having a sale on the pewter mugs at his silversmith shop, even he, with all his enormous personal gifts, could not have galvanized the Massachusetts countryside. In epidemics, the messenger matters. Messengers are what make something spread. But the content of the message matters too. And the specific quality that a message needs to be successful is the quality of stickiness. Is the message, or the food, or the movie, or the product memorable? Is it so memorable, in fact, that it can create change, that it can spur someone to action? Stickiness sounds like it should be straightforward. When most of us want to make sure what we say is remembered, we speak with emphasis. We talk loudly and we repeat what we have to say over and over again. Marketers feel the same way. There's a maxim in the advertising business that an advertisement has to be seen at least 6 times before anyone will remember it. That's a useful message for Coca-Cola or Nike, who have hundreds of millions of dollars to spend on marketing and can afford to saturate all forms of media with their message. But it's not all that useful for, say, a group of people trying to spark a literacy epidemic with a small budget and 1 hour of programming on public television. Are there smaller, subtler, easier ways to make something stick? The answer is that there are, although they lie in areas where we may not expect them to be. If you look closely at epidemic ideas or messages, as often as not, the elements that make them sticky turn out to be small and seemingly trivial. Consider, for example, the so-called fear experiment conducted by the social psychologist Howard Leventhal in the 1960s. Leventhal wanted to see if he could convince a group of college seniors at Yale University to get a tetanus shot. He divided them up into several groups and gave all of them a 7-page booklet explaining the dangers of tetanus, the importance of inoculation, and the fact that the university was offering free tetanus shots at the campus health center to all interested students. The booklets, however, came in several versions. Some of the students were given a high-fear version, which described tetanus in dramatic terms and included color photographs of a child having a tetanus seizure and other tetanus victims with urinary catheters, tracheotomy wounds, and nasal tubes. In the low-fear version, the language describing the risks of tetanus was toned down, and the photographs were omitted. Leventhal wanted to see what impact the different booklets had on the students' attitudes towards tetanus and their likelihood of getting a shot. The results were, in part, quite predictable. When they were given a questionnaire later, all of the students appeared to be well-educated about the dangers of tetanus. But those who were given the high-fear booklet were more convinced of the dangers of tetanus, more convinced of the importance of shots, and were more likely to say that they intended to get inoculated. All of those differences evaporated, however, when Leventhal looked at how many of the students actually went and got a shot. 1 month after the experiments, almost none of the subjects, a mere 3%, had actually gone to the health clinic to get inoculated. For some reason, the students had forgotten everything they had learned about tetanus, and the lessons they had been told weren't translating into action. The experiment didn't stick. Why not? If we didn't know about the stickiness factor, we probably would have concluded that something was wrong with the way the booklet explained tetanus to the students. We might have wondered whether trying to scare them was the appropriate direction to take, or whether there is a social stigma that surrounds tetanus that inhibits students from admitting that they are at risk, or perhaps that medical care itself is intimidating to students. In any case, that only 3% of students responded would suggest that we were a long way from reaching our goal. But the stickiness factor suggests something quite different. It suggests the problem probably isn't with the overall conception of the message at all, and that maybe all the campaign needs is a new approach. Sure enough, when Leventhal redid the experiment, one small change was sufficient to tip the vaccination rate up to 28%. It was simply including a map of the campus, with the University Health Building circled, and the times that shots were available clearly listed, along with a booklet. There are two interesting implications to this study. The first is that of the 28% who got inoculated, an equal number were from the high fear as low fear group. Whatever extra persuasive muscle was found in the high fear booklet was clearly irrelevant. The students knew, without seeing gory pictures, what the dangers of tetanus were and what they ought to be doing. The second interesting thing is that, of course, as seniors, they must have already known where the health center was, and doubtless had visited it several times already. It is doubtful that any of them would ever actually have used the map. In other words, what the tetanus intervention needed in order to tip was not an avalanche of new or additional information. What it needed was a subtle but significant change in presentation. The students needed to know how to fit the tetanus stuff into their lives. The addition of the map and the times when the shots were available shifted the booklet from an abstract lesson in medical risk, a lesson no different from the countless other academic lessons they had received over their academic career, to a practical and personal piece of medical advice. And once the advice became practical and personal, it became memorable. There are enormous implications in Leventhal's fear experiments for the question of how to start and tip social epidemics. We have become, in our society, overwhelmed by people clamoring for our attention. In just the past decade, the time devoted to advertisements in a typical hour of network television has grown from 6 minutes to 9 minutes. The New York-based firm Media Dynamics estimates that the average American is now exposed to 254 different commercial messages in a day. There are now millions of websites on the Internet. Cable systems routinely carry over 50 channels of programming. And a glance inside the magazine section of any Barnes & Noble will tell you that there are thousands of magazines coming out each week and month, chock full of advertising and information. In the advertising business, this surfeit of information is called the clutter problem, and clutter has made it harder and harder to get any one message to stick. Much of what we are told or read or watch, we simply don't remember. The information age has created a stickiness problem. But Leventhal's example suggests that there may be simple ways to enhance stickiness and systematically engineer stickiness into a message. This is a fact of obvious importance to marketers, teachers, and managers. Perhaps no one has done more to illustrate the potential of this kind of stickiness engineering, however, than children's educational television, in particular, the creators of Sesame Street. Sesame Street was built around a single breakthrough insight that if you can hold the attention of children, you can educate them. This may seem obvious, but it isn't. Many critics of television to this day argue that what's dangerous about TV is that it is addictive, that children and even adults watch it like zombies. According to this view, it's the formal features of television, violence, bright lights, loud and funny noises, quick editing cuts, zooming in and out, exaggerated action, and all the other things we associate with commercial TV that hold our attention. In other words, we don't have to understand what we're looking at or absorb what we're seeing in order to keep watching. That's what many people mean when they say television is passive. We watch it when we're stimulated by all the whizzes and bangs of the medium, and we look away or turn the channel when we're bored. What the pioneering television researchers of the 1960s and 1970s, in particular Daniel Anderson at the University of Massachusetts, began to realize, however, is that this isn't how preschoolers watch TV at all. The idea was that kids would sit, stare at the screen, and zone out, said Elizabeth Lorch, a psychologist at Amherst College. But once we began to look carefully at what children were doing, we found out that short looks were actually more common. There was much more variation. Children didn't just sit and stare. They would divide their attention between a couple of different activities. And they weren't being random. They were predictable influences on what made them look back at the screen. And these were not trivial things, not just flash and dash. Lorch, for instance, once re-edited an episode of Sesame Street so that certain key scenes of some of the sketches were out of order. If kids were only interested in flash and dash, that shouldn't have made a difference. The show, after all, still had songs and Muppets and bright colors and action and all the things that make Sesame Street so wonderful. But it did make a difference. The kids stopped watching. If they couldn't make sense of what they were looking at, they weren't going to look at it. In another experiment, Lorch and Anderson showed two groups of five-year-olds an episode of Sesame Street. The kids in the second group, however, were put in a room with lots of very attractive toys on the floor. As you would expect, the kids in the room without the toys watched the show about 87% of the time, while the kids with the toys watched only about 47% of the show. Kids are distracted by toys. But when they tested the two groups to see how much of the show the children remembered and understood, the scores were exactly the same. This result stunned the two researchers. Kids, they realized, were an awful lot more sophisticated in the way they watched than had been imagined. They wrote, "We were led to the conclusion that the five-year-olds in the toys group were attending quite strategically, distributing their attention between toy play and viewing, so that they looked at what for them were the most informative parts of the program. This strategy was so effective that the children could gain no more from increased attention." If you take these two studies together, the toy study and the editing study, you reach quite a radical conclusion about children and television. Kids don't watch when they're stimulated and look away when they're bored. They watch when they understand and look away when they are confused. If you're in the business of educational television, this is a critical difference. It means that if you want to know whether and what kids are learning from a TV show, all you have to do is notice what they're watching. And if you want to know what kids aren't learning, all you have to do is notice what they aren't watching. Preschoolers are so sophisticated in their viewing behavior, in other words, that you can determine the stickiness of children's programming by simple observation. The head of research for Sesame Street in the early years was Ed Palmer, a PhD from Oregon, whose specialty was the use of television as a teaching tool. When the Children's Television Workshop was founded in the late 1960s, Palmer was a natural recruit. "I was the only academic they could find doing research on children's TV," he says. Palmer's innovation was something he called the distractor. It was simply a slide projector and screen that he would set up next to a television monitor. On the monitor, he would play an episode of Sesame Street. On the screen adjacent to the monitor, he would run a slideshow, with one new slide every 7.5 seconds. "We had the most varied set of slides we could imagine," Palmer says. "We would have a boy riding down the street on his bike with his arms out, a picture of a tall building, a leaf floating through ripples of water, a rainbow, a picture taken through a microscope, an Escher drawing. Anything to be novel, that was the idea. Preschoolers would then be brought into the room, two at a time, and told to watch the television show. Palmer and his assistants would sit slightly to the side with a pencil and paper, quietly noting when they were watching Sesame Street and when they lost interest and looked instead at the slideshow. Every time the slide changed, Palmer and his assistants would make a new notation, so that by the end of the show they had an almost second-by-second account of what parts of the episode being tested managed to hold the viewer's attention and what parts did not. The distractor was a stickiness machine. We'd take that big-sized chart paper, 2 by 3 feet, and tape several of those sheets together, Palmer remembers. We had data points, remember, for every 7.5 seconds, which comes to close to 400 data points for a single program. And we'd connect all those dots with a red line, so it would look like a stock market report from Wall Street. It might plummet or gradually decline, and we'd say, "Whoa, what's going on here?" At other times, it might hug the very top of the chart, and we'd say, "Wow, that segment's really grabbing the attention of the kids." We tabulated those distractor scores in percentages. We'd have it up to 100% sometimes. The average attention for most shows was around 85 to 90%. If the producers got that, they were happy. If they got around 50, they'd go back to the drawing board. The distractor showed that no single segment of the Sesame Street format should go beyond 4 minutes, and that 3 minutes was probably optimal. Palmer forced the producers to simplify dialogue and abandon certain techniques that they had taken from adult television. The most important thing that Palmer ever found out with the distractor came at the very beginning, before Sesame Street was even on the air. It was the summer of 1969, and we were a month and a half from air date. Gerald Lesser, a psychologist at Harvard University, was one of the show's founders, remembers. We decided, let's go for broke. Let's produce 5 full shows, 1 hour each, before we go to air and see what we've got. To test the shows, Palmer took them down to Philadelphia, and over the 3rd week of July showed them to groups of preschoolers in 60 different homes. It was a difficult period. Philadelphia was in the midst of a heat wave, which made the children who were supposed to watch the show restless and inattentive. In the same week as well, Apollo 11 landed on the moon, and some children understandably seemed to prefer that historic moment to Sesame Street. Worse for the conclusions was Palmer's distractor. What we found, Lesser says, almost destroyed us. The problem was that when the show was originally conceived, the decision was made that all fantasy elements be separated from the real elements. This was done at the insistence of many child psychologists, who felt that to mix fantasy and reality would be misleading to children. The Muppets, then, were only seen with other Muppets, and the scenes filmed on Sesame Street itself involved only real adults and children. What Palmer found out in Philadelphia, though, was that as soon as they switched to the street scenes, the kids lost all interest. The street was supposed to be the glue, Lesser said. We would always come back to the street. It pulled the show together. But it was just adults doing things and talking about stuff, and the kids weren't interested. We were getting incredibly low attention levels. The kids were leaving the show. Levels would pop back up if the Muppets came back, but we couldn't afford to keep losing them like that. Lesser calls Palmer's results a turning point in the history of Sesame Street. We knew that if we kept the street that way, the show was going to die. Everything was happening so fast. We hit the testing in the summer, and we were going on the air in the fall. We had to figure out what to do. So the producers went back and reshot all of the street scenes. Jim Henson and his co-workers created puppets who could walk and talk with the adults of the show and could live alongside them on the street. That's when Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch and Snuffleupagus were born. What we now think of as the essence of Sesame Street, the artful blend of fluffy monsters and earnest adults, grew out of a desperate desire to be sticky. The distractor, however, for all its strengths, is a fairly crude instrument. It tells you that a child understands what is happening on the screen, and as a result is paying attention. But it doesn't tell you what the child understands, or more precisely, it doesn't tell you whether the child is paying attention to what he or she ought to be paying attention to. To try to understand this question, the research staff at Sesame Street developed another innovative testing program. Consider the following two Sesame Street segments, both of which are called visual blending exercises, segments that teach children that reading consists of blending together distinct sounds. In one, Hug, a female Muppet approaches the word hug in the center of the screen. She stands behind the H, sounding it out carefully, then moves to the U, and then the G. She does it again, moving from left to right, pronouncing each letter separately, before putting the sounds together to say hug. As she does, the Muppet Harry Monster enters and repeats the word as well. The segment ends with the Harry Monster hugging the delighted little girl Muppet. In another segment called Oscar's Blending, Oscar the Grouch and the Muppet Crummy play a game called Breakable Words, in which words are assembled and then taken apart. Oscar starts by calling for C, which pops up in the lower left corner of the screen. C, Oscar tells Crummy, is pronounced K. Then the letters AT pop up in the lower right-hand corner, and Crummy sounds the letters out, AT. The two go back and forth, Oscar saying K and Crummy AT, each time faster and faster, until the sounds blend together to make CAT. As this happens, the letters at the bottom of the screen move together as well to make CAT. The two Muppets repeat CAT a few times, and then the word drops from sight, accompanied by a crashing sound. Then the process begins again with the word bat. Both of these segments are entertaining. They hold children's attention. On the distractor, they score brilliantly. But do they actually teach the fundamentals of reading? That's a much harder question. To answer it, the producers of Sesame Street called in a group of researchers at Harvard University, led by a psychologist named Barbara Flagg, who are experts in something called eye movement photography. Eye movement research is based on the idea that the human eye is capable of focusing on only a very small area at one time, what's called our perceptual span. When most of us read, we focus on chunks of text, usually one keyword and then four characters to the left and 15 characters to the right. That lingering focus is called a fixation. The reason you can only focus clearly on that much text is that most of the sensors in your eye, the receptors that process what you see, are clustered in a small region in the very middle of the retina called the fovea. That's why you move your eyes when you read. You can't pick up much information about the shape or the color or the structure of words unless you focus your fovea directly on them. If you can track where someone's fovea is moving, you can tell with extraordinary precision what they are actually looking at and what kind of information they are actually receiving. The people who make television commercials, not surprisingly, are obsessed with eye tracking. If you make a beer commercial with a beautiful model, it would be really important to know whether the average 22-year-old male in your target audience focuses his fovea only on the model or eventually moves to your can of beer. Sesame Street went to Harvard in 1975 for the same reason. When kids watched Oscar's Blending or Hug, were they watching and learning about the words, or were they simply watching the Muppets? The experiment was conducted with 21 4- and 5-year-olds, who were brought to the Harvard School of Education over the course of a week by their parents. One by one, they were seated in an antique barber's chair with a padded headrest about 3 feet away from a 17-inch color television monitor. A Gulf and Western infrared eye view monitor was set up just off to the left, carefully calibrated to track the fovea movements of each subject. What they found was that Hug was a resounding success. 76% of all fixations were on the letters. Better still, 83% of all preschoolers fixated on the letters in a left-to-right sequence, mimicking, in other words, the actual reading process. Oscar's Blending, on the other hand, was a disaster. Only 35% of total fixations fell on the print. And exactly 0% of the preschoolers read the letters from left to right. What was the problem? First, the letters shouldn't have been on the bottom of the screen because, as almost all eye movement research demonstrates, when it comes to television, people tend to fixate on the center of the screen. That issue, though, is really secondary to the simple fact that the kids weren't watching the letters because they were watching Oscar. They were watching the model and not the beer can. I remember Oscar's Blending, Flagg says. Oscar was very active. He was really making a fuss in the background. And the word is not close to him at all. He's moving his mouth a lot, moving his hands. There's a great deal of distraction. The kids don't focus on letters at all because Oscar is so interesting. Oscar was sticky. The lesson wasn't. There is something profoundly counterintuitive in the definition of stickiness that emerges from these examples. Leventhal found out that the hard sell, but trying to scare students into getting tetanus shots, didn't work. And what really worked was giving them a map they didn't need, directing them to a clinic that they already knew existed. We all want to believe that the key to making an impact on someone lies with the inherent quality of the ideas we present. But in none of these cases did anyone substantially alter the content of what they were saying. Instead, they tipped a message by tinkering with things on the margin, by putting the Muppet behind the HUG, mixing Big Bird with the adults. The line between hostility and acceptance, in other words, between an epidemic that tips and one that does not, is sometimes a lot narrower than it seems. The creators of Sesame Street did not junk their entire show after the Philadelphia disaster. They just added Big Bird, and he made all the difference in the world. Howard Leventhal didn't redouble his efforts to terrify his students into getting a tetanus shot. He just threw in a map and a set of appointment times. The law of the few says there are exceptional people out there who are capable of starting epidemics. All you have to do is find them. Stickiness is the same way. There are simple ways to package information that, under the right circumstances, can make it irresistible. All you have to do is find it. New York City, in the 1980s, was in the grip of one of the worst crime epidemics in its history. But then, suddenly and without warning, the epidemic tipped. The murder rate peaked in 1990, then went into a steep and precipitous decline. Murders dropped by two-thirds. Felonies were cut in half. Other cities saw their crime drop in the same period, but in no place did the level of violence fall farther or faster. On the subways, by the end of the decade, there were 75% fewer felonies than there had been at the decade's start. The idea of crime as an epidemic, it must be said, is a little strange. We talk about epidemics of violence, or crime waves, but it's not clear that we really believe that crime follows the same rules of epidemics as, say, Hush Puppies did, or Paul Revere's Ride. Those epidemics involve relatively straightforward and simple things, a product and a message. Crime, on the other hand, isn't a single discrete thing, but a word used to describe an almost impossibly varied and complicated set of behaviors. Criminal acts have serious consequences. They require the criminal to do something that puts himself at great personal peril. To say that someone is a criminal is to say that they are evil or violent or dangerous or dishonest or unstable or any combination of any of those things, none of which are psychological states that sound like they can be transmitted casually from one person to another. Criminals do not, in other words, sound like the kind of people who could be swept up by the infectious winds of an epidemic. Yet somehow, in New York City, this is exactly what happened. In the years between the beginning and the middle of the 1990s, New York City did not get a population transplant. Nobody went out into the streets and successfully taught every would-be delinquent the distinction between right and wrong. There were just as many psychologically damaged people and criminally inclined people living in the city at the peak of the crime wave as at the trough. But for some reason, tens of thousands of those people suddenly stopped committing crimes. How did that happen? The answer lies in the third of the principles of epidemic transmission, the power of context. The law of the few looked at the kinds of people who are critical in spreading information. The section on Sesame Street looked at the question of stickiness, suggesting that in order to be capable of sparking epidemics, ideas have to be memorable and move us to action. We've looked at the people who spread ideas, and we've looked at the characteristics of successful ideas. But the subject of this section, the power of context, is no less important than the first two. Epidemics are sensitive to the conditions and circumstances of the times and places in which they occur. In Baltimore, syphilis spreads far more in the summer than in the winter. Hush puppies took off because they were being worn by kids in the cutting-edge precincts of the East Village, an environment which helped others to look at the shoes in a new light. It could even be argued that the success of Paul Revere's Midnight Ride, in some way, owed itself to the fact that it was made at midnight. At midnight, everyone is home in bed, which makes them an awful lot easier to reach than if they're off on errands or working in the fields. And if someone wakes us up to tell us something, we automatically assume the news is going to be urgent. One can only imagine how Paul Revere's afternoon ride might have compared. This much, I think, is relatively straightforward. But the lesson of the power of context is that we are more than just sensitive to changes in context. We're exquisitely sensitive to them. And the kind of contextual changes that are capable of tipping an epidemic are very different than we might ordinarily suspect. During the 1990s, violent crime declined across the United States for a number of fairly obvious reasons. The illegal trade in crack cocaine, which had spawned a great deal of violence among gangs and drug dealers, began to decline. The economy's dramatic recovery meant that many people who might have been lured into crime got legitimate jobs instead. And the aging of the baby boom population meant that there were fewer people in the age range, males between 18 and 24, that is responsible for the majority of all violence. The question of why crime declined in New York City, however, is a little more complicated. In the period when the New York crime epidemic tipped down, the city's economy hadn't improved. It was still stagnant. In fact, the city's poorest neighborhoods had just been hit hard by the welfare cuts of the early 1990s. The waning of the crack cocaine epidemic in New York was clearly a factor, but then again, it had been in steady decline well before crime dipped. As for the aging of the population, because of the heavy immigration to New York in the 1980s, the city was getting younger in the 1990s, not older. In any case, all of these trends are long-term changes that one could expect to have gradual effects. In New York, the decline was anything but gradual. Something else clearly played a role in reversing New York's crime epidemic. The most intriguing candidate for that something else is called the broken windows theory. Broken windows was the brainchild of the criminologists James Q. Wilson and George Kelling. Wilson and Kelling argued that crime is the inevitable result of disorder. If a window is broken and left unrepaired, people walking by will conclude that no one cares and no one is in charge. Soon, more windows will be broken, and the sense of anarchy will spread from the building to the street on which it faces, sending a signal that anything goes. In a city, relatively minor problems like graffiti, public disorder, and aggressive panhandling, they write, are all the equivalent of broken windows, invitations to more serious crimes. This is an epidemic theory of crime. It says that crime is contagious, that it can start with a broken window and spread to an entire community. The tipping point of this epidemic, though, isn't a particular kind of person, a connector or a maven. It's something physical like graffiti. The impetus to engage in a certain kind of behavior is coming from a feature of the environment. In the mid-1980s, Kelling was hired by the New York Transit Authority as a consultant, and he urged them to put the broken windows theory into practice. They obliged, bringing in a new subway director by the name of David Gunn to oversee a multi-billion-dollar rebuilding of the subway system. Many subway advocates, at the time, told Gunn not to worry about graffiti, to focus on the larger questions of crime and subway reliability, and it seemed like reasonable advice. But Gunn insisted. The graffiti was symbolic of the collapse of the system, he says. When you looked at the process of rebuilding the organization and morale, you had to win the battle against graffiti. We were about to put out new trains that were worth about $10 million apiece, and unless we did something to protect them, we knew just what would happen. They would last one day, and then they would be vandalized. He drew up a new management structure and a precise set of goals and timetables, aimed at cleaning the system line by line, train by train. He started with the number 7 train that connects Queens to Midtown Manhattan and began experimenting with new techniques to clean off the paint. On stainless steel cars, they used solvents. On the painted cars, they simply painted over the graffiti. Gunn made it a rule that there should be no retreat, that once a car was reclaimed, it should never be allowed to be vandalized again. At the end of the number 1 line in the Bronx, where the train stopped before turning around and going back to Manhattan, Gunn set up a cleaning station. If a car came in with graffiti, the graffiti had to be removed during the changeover, or the car was removed from service. The idea was to send an unambiguous message to the vandals themselves. Gunn's graffiti cleanup took from 1984 to 1990. At that point, the Transit Authority hired William Bratton to head the transit police, and the second stage of the reclamation of the subway system began. Bratton was a disciple of Broken Windows, so his first step as police chief was as seemingly quixotic as Gunn's. With felonies, serious crimes, on the subway system at an all-time high, Bratton decided to crack down on fare beating. Why? Because he believed that fare beating was a tipping point, a small sign of disorder that invited much more serious crimes. An estimated 170,000 people a day were entering the system, by one route or another, without paying a token. Some were kids who simply jumped over the turnstiles. Others would lean backwards on the turnstiles and force their way through. The problem was that once one or two or three people began doing it, other people, who might never otherwise have considered evading the law, would join in, reasoning that if some people weren't going to pay, they shouldn't either, and the problem would snowball. At the same time, fare beating was a difficult problem to fight. Because there was only $1.25 at stake, it didn't seem like the kind of crime to merit extraordinary measures. The transit police didn't feel like it was worth their time to stand by the turnstiles, when there were plenty of more serious crimes happening down on the platform and in the trains. Bratton quickly made his presence felt. He would roam the city on the subway at night, getting a sense of what the problems were and how best to fight them. First, he picked stations where fare beating was the biggest problem, and put as many as 10 policemen in plain clothes at the turnstiles. The team would nab fare beaters one by one, handcuff them, and leave them standing in a daisy chain on the platform until they had a full catch. The idea was to signal, as publicly as possible, that the transit police were now serious about cracking down on fare beaters. Previously, police officers had been wary of pursuing fare beaters because the arrest, the trip to the station house, the filling out of necessary forms, and the waiting for those forms to be processed took an entire day, all for a crime that usually merited no more than a slap on the wrist. Bratton retrofitted a city bus and turned it into a rolling station house, with its own fax machines, phones, holding pen, and fingerprinting facilities. Soon the turnaround time on an arrest was down to an hour. Bratton also insisted that a check be run on all those arrested. Sure enough, 1 out of 7 arrestees had an outstanding warrant for a previous crime, and 1 out of 20 was carrying a weapon of some sort. Suddenly, it wasn't hard to convince police officers that tackling fare beating made sense. Under Bratton, the number of ejections from subway stations for drunkenness or improper behavior tripled within his first few months in office. arrests for misdemeanors, for the kind of minor offenses that had gone unnoticed in the past, went up fivefold between 1990 and 1994. Bratton turned the transit police into an organization focused on the smallest infractions, on the details of life underground. After the election of Rudolph Giuliani as mayor of New York in 1994, Bratton was appointed head of the New York City Police Department, and he applied the same strategies to the city at large. He instructed his officers to crack down on quality of life crimes, on the squeegee men who came up to drivers at New York City intersections and demanded money for washing car windows, for example, and on all the other above-ground equivalents of turnstile jumping and graffiti. Bratton says, if you peed in the street, you were going to jail. When crime began to fall in the city, as quickly and dramatically as it had in the subways, Bratton and Giuliani pointed to the same cause. Minor, seemingly insignificant quality of life crimes, they said, were tipping points for violent crime. The broken windows theory and the power of context are one and the same. They are both based on the premise that an epidemic can be reversed, can be tipped, by tinkering with the smallest details of the immediate environment. They say that the criminal is actually someone acutely sensitive to his environment, who is alert to all kinds of cues, and who decides to commit crimes based on his perception of the world around him. The power of context says you don't have to solve the big problems to solve crime. You can prevent crimes just by scrubbing off graffiti and arresting fare beaters. The crime epidemics have tipping points, every bit as simple and straightforward as syphilis in Baltimore or a fashion trend like hush puppies. The essence of the power of context is that for certain kinds of environments, our interstates are the result of our outer circumstances. Once you understand that context matters, that specific and relatively small elements in the environment can serve as tipping points, the defeatism that for so long has characterized our approach to crime is turned upside down. Environmental tipping points are things that we can change. We can fix broken windows and clean up graffiti and change the signals that invite crime in the first place. Crime can be more than understood. It can be prevented. There is a broader dimension to this. There are a number of studies of things like juvenile delinquency and high school dropout rates that suggest that peer influence and community influence are more important than family influence in determining how children turn out. The studies show, essentially, that a child is better off in a good neighborhood and a troubled family than he or she is in a troubled neighborhood and a good family. We spend so much time celebrating the importance and power of family influence that this may seem, at first blush, like it can't be true. But in reality, it is no more than an obvious and commonsensical extension of the power of context, because it says simply that children are powerfully shaped by their external environment, that the features of our immediate social and physical world, the streets we walk down, the people we encounter, play a huge role in shaping who we are and how we act. It isn't just serious criminal behavior, in the end, that is sensitive to environmental cues. It is all behavior. In 1996, a sometimes actress and playwright by the name of Rebecca Wells published a book entitled Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood. Its arrival in the bookstores was not a major literary event. When Wells gave a reading soon after her book was published in Greenwich, Connecticut, there were 7 people in the audience. She had a smattering of reviews here and there, mostly positive, and in the end, her book sold a very respectable 15,000 copies in hardcover. A year later, Ya-Ya Sisterhood, as the book became known, came out in paperback. The first edition of 18,000 copies sold out in the first few months. By June of 1997, total paperback sales hit 30,000, and both Wells and her editor began to get the creeping sense that something strange and wonderful was about to happen. I'd be signing books, and there would be groups of women who would come together, 6 or 7 women, and they would have me sign anywhere between 3 and 10 books, she remembered later. And I was personalizing everything. They would have me sign to their grandmothers or mothers or sisters. Wells's editor, Diane Reverend, went to her marketing people and said it was time for an advertising campaign. They bought one ad opposite the contents page of the New Yorker magazine, and in the space of a month, sales doubled from 30 to 60,000. Going from one reading to the next across the country, Wells began to see changes in the composition of her audience. I started noticing mothers and daughters coming. The daughters would be in their late 30s, early 40s. The mothers were of the generation who went to high school during World War II. Then I noticed that there started to be three generations coming, 20-somethings as well. And then, to my total delight, there would be teenagers and fifth graders. Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood was not yet on the best-seller lists. That wouldn't happen until much later, when it would hit the charts and stay there through 48 printings and 2.5 million copies. The national media attention, the articles in big women's magazines, and the appearance on television shows that would turn Wells into a celebrity hadn't started yet either. But through the power of word of mouth, her book had tipped. The turning point for me was probably in Northern California, the winter after the paperback came out, Wells said. I walked into a situation where all of a sudden there were 700 and 800 people at my readings. Why did Ya-Ya Sisterhood turn into an epidemic? In retrospect, the answer seems fairly straightforward. The book itself is heartwarming and beautifully written, a compelling story of friendship and mother-daughter relationships. It spoke to people. It's sticky. Then there's the fact that Wells herself is an actress. She didn't read from her novel as she traveled across the country, so much as she acted it out, playing each character with such skill that she turned her readings into performances. Wells is a classic salesman. But there is a third, less obvious factor here, which has to do with the last of the principles of epidemics. The success of Ya-Ya is a tribute to the power of context. More specifically, it is testimony to the power of one specific aspect of context, which is the critical role that groups play in social epidemics. In a way, this is an obvious observation. Anyone who has ever been to the movies knows that the size of the crowd in the theater has a big effect on how good the movie seems. Comedies are never funnier, and thrillers never more thrilling than in a packed movie house. Psychologists tell us much the same thing, that when people are asked to consider evidence or make decisions in a group, they come to very different conclusions than when they're asked the same questions by themselves. Once we're part of a group, we're all susceptible to peer pressure and social norms and any number of other kinds of influence that can play a critical role in sweeping people up in the beginnings of an epidemic. Have you ever wondered, for example, how religious movements get started? Usually we think of them as the product of highly charismatic evangelists, people like the Apostle Paul or Billy Graham or Brigham Young. But the spread of any new and contagious ideology also has a lot to do with the skillful use of group power. In the late 18th and early 19th century, for example, the Methodist movement became epidemic in England and North America, tipping from 20,000 to 90,000 followers in the U.S. in the space of 5 or 6 years in the 1780s. But Methodism's founder, John Wesley, was by no means the most charismatic preacher of his era. Nor was Wesley a great theologian in the tradition of, say, John Calvin or Martin Luther. His genius was organizational. Wesley would travel around England and North America, delivering open-air sermons to thousands of people. But he didn't just preach. He also stayed long enough in each town to form the most enthusiastic of his converts into religious societies, which in turn he subdivided into smaller classes of a dozen or so people. Each convert was required to attend weekly meetings, to adhere to a strict code of conduct. If they failed to live up to the Methodist standards, they were expelled from the group. This was a group, in other words, that meant something. Over the course of his life, Wesley traveled ceaselessly among these groups, covering as much as 4,000 miles a year by horseback, reinforcing the tenets of Methodist belief. He was a classic connector. He was a super Paul Revere. The difference is, though, that he wasn't one person with ties to many people. He was one person with ties to many groups, which is a small but critical distinction. Wesley realized that if he wanted to bring about a fundamental change in someone's belief and behavior, a change that would persist and serve as an example to others, you needed to create a community around the converts, where those new beliefs could be practiced and expressed and nurtured. This is why Ya-Ya Sisterhood tipped as well. The first bestseller list on which Ya-Ya appeared was the Northern California Independent Booksellers List. Northern California, as Wells said, was where 600 and 700 people first began showing up at her readings. It was where the Ya-Ya epidemic began. Why? According to Reverend, because the San Francisco area is home to one of the country's strongest book group cultures. And from the beginning, Ya-Ya was what publishers refer to as a book group book. The groups of seven women who Wells noticed coming to her readings were invariably all members of the same reading group. The book group movement of the past decade is, to some extent, a phenomenon of adult women. And Yaya's Sisterhood was a book about the lifelong friendship of a group of adult women. It was the kind of book that people wanted to talk about. And because it was talked about in groups, it became that much stickier. It's easier to remember and appreciate something, after all, if you discuss it for 2 hours with your best friends. It becomes a social experience, an object of conversation, which is why it's not hard to understand how Yaya sparked a word-of-mouth epidemic. Wells says that at the end of her readings, during the question-and-answer session, women in the audience would tell her, "We've been in a book group for 2 years, and then we read your book and something else happened. It started to drop down to a level of sharing that was more like friendship. They told me that they had started going to the beach together or having parties at each other's houses." Women began forming Yaya Sisterhood groups of their own in imitation of the group described in the book and bringing Wells pictures of their group for her to sign. Wesley's Methodism spread like wildfire through England and America because Wesley was shuttling back and forth among hundreds and hundreds of groups, and each group was then taking his message and making it even stickier. The word about Yaya was spreading in the same way, from reading group to reading group, from Yaya group to Yaya group, and from one of Wells's readings to another, because for over a year she stopped everything else and toured the country nonstop. But if the lesson of Yaya and John Wesley is that small, close-knit groups have the power to magnify the epidemic potential of a message or idea, that conclusion still leaves a number of critical questions unanswered. The word group, for instance, is a term used to describe everything from a basketball team to the Teamsters Union, from two couples on a holiday to the Republican Party. If we are interested in starting an epidemic, in reaching a tipping point, what are the most effective kinds of groups? Is there any simple rule of thumb that distinguishes a group with real social authority from a group with little power at all? As it turns out, there is. It's called the Rule of 150, and it is a fascinating example of the strange and unexpected ways in which context affects the course of social epidemics. There is a concept in cognitive psychology called the channel capacity, which refers to the amount of space in our brain for certain kinds of information. Suppose, for example, that I played you a number of different musical tones at random and asked you to identify each one with a number. If I played you a really low tone, you would call it 1, and if I played you a medium tone, you would call it 2, and a high tone, you would call it 3. The purpose of the test is to find out how long you can continue to distinguish among different tones. People with perfect pitch, of course, can play this game indefinitely. You can play them dozens of tones and they'll be able to distinguish between all of them. But for the majority of us, this game is much harder. Most people can only divide tones into about 6 different categories before they begin to make mistakes and start lumping different tones in the same category. This is a remarkably consistent finding. If, for example, I played you 5 very high-pitched tones, you'd be able to tell them apart. And if I played you 5 very low-pitched tones, you'd also be able to tell them apart. You'd think, then, that if I combined those high and low tones and played them for you all at once, you'd be able to divide them into 10 categories. But you won't be able to. Chances are, you'll still be stuck at about 6 categories. This natural limit shows up again and again in simple tests. If I made you drink 20 glasses of iced tea, each with different amounts of sugar in them, and ask you to sort them into categories according to sweetness, you'll only be able to divide them into 6 or 7 different categories before you begin to make mistakes. Or if I flash dots on a screen in front of you very quickly and ask you to count how many you saw, you'd get the number right up to about 7 dots, and then you'd need to guess. There seems to be some limitation built into us, either by learning or by the design of our nervous systems, a limit that keeps our channel capacities in this general range, the psychologist George Miller concluded in his famous essay, The Magical Number 7. This is the reason that telephone numbers have 7 digits. Bell wanted a number to be as long as possible so they could have as large a capacity as possible, but not so long that people couldn't remember it, says Jonathan Cohen, a memory researcher at Princeton University. At 8 or 9 digits, the local telephone number would exceed the human channel capacity. There would be many more wrong numbers. As human beings, in other words, we can only handle so much information at once. Once we pass a certain boundary, we become overwhelmed. What I'm describing here is an intellectual capacity, our ability to process raw information. But if you think about it, we clearly have a channel capacity for feelings as well. I had a friend recently tell me that her grandmother had died. When I expressed my regrets, she thanked me, but added that her grandmother had been senile and very ill for many years, so that her family was as much relieved as distraught. Her explanation made perfect sense to me, as I think it would to most people. Death, even the death of someone as close to us as a grandmother, is not a uniformly tragic event. We don't feel as bad when a relative dies in their sleep at 95 as we do when someone we love dies in a car accident at 25. But why do we make that calculation? After all, in both cases, someone very close to us has died. I think the answer is that we all recognize that our capacity for compassion and empathy are finite, and we have to make choices about how best to parcel out our strongest feelings. Take a minute, for example, to make a list of all the people you know whose death would leave you truly devastated. Chances are you'll come up with about 12 names. That, at least, is the average answer that most people give to that question. Those names make up what psychologists call our sympathy group. Why aren't groups any larger? Partly, it's a question of time. If you look at the names on your sympathy list, they're probably the people who you devote the most attention to, either on the telephone, in person, or thinking and worrying about. If your list was twice as long, if it had 30 names on it, and as a result, you spent only half as much time with everyone on it, would you still be as close to everyone? Probably not. To be someone's best friend requires a minimal investment of time. More than that, though, it takes emotional energy. Caring about someone deeply is exhausting. At a certain point, at somewhere between 10 and 15 people, we begin to overload, just as we begin to overload when we have to distinguish between too many tones. It's a function of the way humans are constructed. As the anthropologist S.L. Washburn writes, most of human evolution took place before the advent of agriculture, when men lived in small groups on a face-to-face basis. As a result, human biology has evolved as an adaptive mechanism to conditions that have largely ceased to exist. Man evolved to feel strongly about few people, short distances, and relatively brief intervals of time, and these are still the dimensions of life that are important to him. Perhaps the most interesting natural limit, however, is what might be called our social channel capacity. The case for a social capacity has been made, most persuasively, by the British anthropologist Robin Dunbar. Dunbar begins with a simple observation. Primates have the biggest brains of all mammals. More importantly, a specific part of the brains of humans and other primates, the region known as the neocortex that deals with complex thought and reasoning, is huge by mammal standards. For years, scientists have argued back and forth about why this is the case. The answer, Dunbar says, is group size. If you look at any species of primate, at every variety of monkey and ape, the larger their cortex is, the larger the average size of the groups they live with. Dunbar's argument is that brains evolve, they get bigger, in order to handle the complexities of larger social groups. If you belong to a group of 5 people, he points out, you have to keep track of 10 separate relationships. Your relationships with the 4 others in your circle, and the 6 other two-way relationships between the others. That's what it means to know everyone in the circle. You have to understand the personal dynamic between each person, juggle different personalities, keep people happy, manage the demands on your own time and attention, and so forth. If you belong to a group of 20 people, however, there are now 190 two-way relationships to keep track of, 19 involving yourself, and 171 involving the rest of the group. That's a 5-fold increase in the size of the group, but a 20-fold increase in the amount of information processing needed to know the other members of the group. Even a relatively small increase in the size of a group, in other words, creates a huge additional social and intellectual burden. Humans socialize in the largest groups of all primates because we are the only animals with brains large enough to handle the complexities of that social arrangement. Dunbar has actually developed an equation, which works for most primates, in which he plugs in what he calls the neocortex ratio for particular species, the size of the neocortex relative to the size of the brain, and the equation spits out the expected maximum group size of the animal. If you plug in the neocortex ratio for Homo sapiens, you get a group estimate of 147.8, or roughly 150. Dunbar writes, "The figure of 150 seems to represent the maximum number of individuals with whom we can have a genuinely social relationship, the kind of relationship that goes with knowing who they are and how they relate to us. Putting it another way, it's a number of people you would not feel embarrassed about joining uninvited for a drink if you happen to bump into them in a bar." Dunbar has combed through the anthropological literature and found that the number 150 pops up again and again. For example, he looks at 21 different hunter-gatherer societies from which we have solid historical evidence, from the Walbiri of Australia to the Tuatha of New Guinea, and found that the average size of their villages was 148.4. We have seen in this program how a number of relatively minor changes in our external environment can have a dramatic effect on how we behave and who we are. Clean up graffiti, and all of a sudden people who would otherwise commit crimes suddenly don't. The rule of 150 suggests that the size of a group is another one of those subtle contextual factors that can make a big difference. If we want groups to serve as incubators for contagious messages, as they did in the case of Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood, we have to keep them below the 150 tipping point. Above that point, there starts to be structural impediments for the ability of the group to agree and act with one voice. Crossing the 150 line is a small change that can make a huge difference. Perhaps the best example of an organization that has successfully navigated this problem is Gore Associates, a privately held, multi-billion-dollar high-tech firm based in Newark, Delaware. At Gore, there are no titles. If you ask someone who works there for their card, it will just say their name and underneath it the word associate, regardless of how much money they make, or how much responsibility they have, or how long they've been at the company. People don't have bosses, they have sponsors, mentors, who watch out for their interests. There are no organization charts, no budgets, no elaborate strategic plans. Salaries are determined collectively. Headquarters for the company is a low-slung, unpretentious red brick building. The executive offices are small, plainly furnished rooms along a narrow corridor. The corners of Gore buildings tend to be conference rooms or free space, so no one can be said to have a more prestigious office than someone else. When I visited a Gore associate named Bob Henn at one of the company's plants in Delaware, I tried unsuccessfully to get him to tell me what his position was. I suspected, from the fact that he had been recommended to me, that he was one of the top executives. But his office wasn't any bigger than anyone else's. His card just called him an associate. He didn't seem to have a secretary that I could see anyway. He wasn't dressed any differently from anyone else. Gore is, in short, a very unusual company with a clear and well-articulated philosophy. It's a big, established company attempting to behave like a small entrepreneurial startup. By all accounts, that attempt has been wildly successful. Gore has a rate of employee turnover that is about a third of the industry average. They've made a profit in 35 consecutive years. They have growth rates and an innovative, high-profit product line that is the envy of the industry. Gore has managed to create a small company ethos so infectious and sticky that it has survived their growth into a billion-dollar company with thousands of employees. And how did they do that? By, among other things, adhering to the rule of 150. Wilbert Bill Gore, the late founder of the company, seems to have stumbled on the principle by trial and error. "We found out again and again that things get clumsy at 150, he told an interviewer some years ago, so 150 employees per plant became the company goal. In the electronics division of the company, that means that no plant was built larger than 50,000 square feet, since there was almost no way to put much more than 150 people in a building that size. People used to ask me, 'How do you do long-term planning?' Hen said. And I'd say, 'That's easy. We put 150 parking spaces in the lot, and when people start parking on the grass, we know it's time to build a new plant.' That new plant didn't have to be far away. There was one site in Delaware, for example, that is three plants within a stone's throw of each other. The buildings only have to be distinct enough to allow for an individual culture in each. We found that a parking lot is a big gap between buildings, one longtime associate Bert Chase told me. You've got to pick yourself up and walk across a lot, and that's a big effort. That's almost enough effort as it takes to get in your car and drive 5 miles. There's a lot of independence in just having a separate building. As Gore has grown in recent years, the company has undergone an almost constant process of division and redivision. It's not hard to see the connection between this kind of organizational structure and the unusual free-form management style of Gore. The kind of bond that Dunbar describes in small groups is essentially a kind of peer pressure. It's knowing people well enough that what they think of you matters. Gore doesn't need formal management structures in its small plants. It doesn't need the usual layers of middle and upper management, because in groups that small, informal personal relationships are more effective. The pressure that comes to bear if we are not efficient at a plant, if we are not creating good earnings for the company, the peer pressure is unbelievable, Jim Buckley, a longtime associate of the firm, told me. This is what you get when you have small teams, where everybody knows everybody. Peer pressure is much more powerful than a concept of a boss. People want to live up to what's expected of them. In order to be unified, then, in order to spread a specific company ideology to all of its employees, Gore had to break itself up into semi-autonomous small pieces. That is the paradox of the epidemic, that in order to create one contagious movement, you often have to create many small movements first. Rebecca Wells says that what she began to realize as the yah-yah epidemic grew was that it wasn't really about her or even about her book. It wasn't one epidemic focused on one thing. It was thousands of different epidemics, all focused on the yah-yah group. I began to realize, she said, that these women had built their own yah-yah relationships, not so much to the book, but to each other.